This is The Guardian.
Today, how to save the world by counting to zero. If you've been following the build-up to the COP26 summit, you'll have heard the phrase net zero an awful lot.
The British government has released a raft of policies today, all aimed at hitting ambitious carbon reduction targets.
And I'm pleased to announce two major government initiatives, the net zero strategy and the heat and building strategy.
Said to be the most comprehensive plan of any major industrialised country. And with just
that's the idea that we need to stop or offset all carbon emissions if we're going to stand a chance of keeping global temperature rises under control.
To adapt Gordon Gekko, who may or may not be a hero of anybody in this room, green is good, green is right, green works.
Last week, Boris Johnson revealed the UK's plan to get there by 2050. So what would a net zero world look like?
What you will see will be a nicer environment, because you will see an environment that's more livable, that's more centred on people. So you won't see as many cars. There may still be cars, they'll be electric. We would get cleaner air, cleaner water. We will also see less waste because we will be doing away with things like single-use plastics. So the idea is that actually the environment that we live in will be much more human and geared towards us and healthier. And that's perfectly achievable. We just need to set out with that goal.
Fiona Harvey, The Guardian's environment correspondent, knows a lot of people think of that as a very painful target. But she doesn't see it that way.
I'm a bit reluctant to use the term sacrifice, because is it a sacrifice to walk down a street where there are no cars? Is it a sacrifice to eat a bit more healthy food that doesn't contain, say, processed meat? You know, these things I don't think we will see as sacrifices in the future. I think once people have tried them and have realised that actually life can be more pleasant, more livable, you know, the air is cleaner, it's fresher, people feel healthier. That, I think, is worth having. I don't think that's a sacrifice.
It's a rosy picture, and the government seems very optimistic, but making it happen isn't going to be easy.
It will be hard to get there because of the place we're starting from. We haven't made the changes in the past 20 years that we could have. So we're starting from a point where we have left these things quite late.
In Glasgow next month, the world's governments are going to try to catch up. If they can do it, there's reason to hope. And if they can't, that vision of the future might never become a reality. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, why net zero matters and what it's going to take to get there. Fiona, you've been covering the climate for almost 20 years and you're going to be at COP26 next month for The Guardian. One of the key phrases we keep hearing as we get closer to the summit, particularly in the British government's proposals on how to make the economy greener, is this phrase net zero. What exactly does it mean?
Net zero means that you reduce greenhouse gas emissions as far as possible. That means switching to clean energy away from fossil fuels. That means changing industrial processes so that they use less carbon. You reduce the greenhouse gas emissions as far as you can, and then there might be some left. So, for instance, there are some sectors that are very hard to decarbonize. What you do at that point is you cancel out the impact of those emissions on the climate by doing things that absorb carbon from the air. So that can be growing more trees. It can be restoring peatlands and wetlands, which also store carbon. It can be improving the soil, managing the soil better. These are ways of absorbing carbon in the natural world. But there are limits to how much we can do that. So the important thing is to reduce emissions as far as possible before you start offsetting the remainder by using carbon sinks.
As a concept, net zero has fast become the guiding principle of climate action. But when did governments first recognise it in policymaking? And when did they first begin to use it to set targets to tackle global warming?
You won't find a reference to net zero in the Paris Agreement of 2015.
Right.
Paris was the first time that developed and developing countries got together and agreed to hold the world to certain temperature limits. So at Paris, it was decided that we should hold global warming to well below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, with an aspiration to keep warming below 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. After the Paris Agreement, we had a landmark scientific report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the global authority on climate science. What they realized was that that's what scientists really looked into in detail, and they found that staying within 1.5 degrees is much safer than allowing temperatures to rise to 2 degrees. So after the Paris Agreement, people started to coalesce around the idea of net zero. And so all the major countries started setting out to do this.
We have set our objective to become the first carbon neutral continent by 2050.
You got the European Union set out a Green Deal. The UK passed a law about reaching net zero.
And that's why today we're announcing that we will be ending our contribution to climate change by 2050 and legislating for a net zero emissions target.
Other countries, developed and developing around the world, have since done the same. And we've now got net zero goals from countries responsible for about two-thirds of global emissions.
A cry for survival comes from the planet itself. A cry that can't be any more desperate or any more clear. And now
they include the United States, China, which has a goal of reaching net zero by 2060, and many other members of the G20. However, we don't have universal buy-in for the net zero goal, and that's one of the aims of the COP26 conference.
In economic terms, you've said it will cost the UK around 1% of GDP until 2050 to meet its climate goals. How do you set that against the cost of doing nothing?
The costs of doing nothing are very high because the costs of climate change encompass everything, really. If we allow climate change to rise above 1.5 degrees, then we will see a massive increase in extreme weather all around the world. We will see droughts, floods, heat waves, fiercer storms, sea level rises. What that means in the UK, we've already seen some quite weird weather.
The heat wave most of Britain's basked in for more than a month broke in a crescendo of thunderstorms and downpours.
Torrents of water gushed out on Thursday, prompting the evacuation of thousands of residents told to take pets and medication with them.
The river came in throughout the garden, and the sheer volume of it and the persistence of it has caught us out.
Is this the new normal, quickly?
I very much fear it will be the new normal if we don't take action very, very soon. It's all very well for Boris to turn up with his mop, but the bottom line is there is an emergency. It's a climate emergency.
So the costs of that are, eventually they'll be too high to calculate. But even in the short term, they run to many tens and probably hundreds of billions.
So climate scientists are clear that the amount of global warming we're seeing is proportional to the amount of carbon dioxide that human activity adds to the atmosphere. So let's dig into some of the details of the proposed plans. What are the easiest ways to make big inroads on getting to net zero that we're seeing governments adopt?
Renewable energy is the most important thing. Replacing fossil fuels with wind farms, solar, and perhaps even other low-carbon forms of energy, such as nuclear power.
And so last week, the British government explained how it would approach all of that in its new net zero policy. What did that strategy reveal? And do you think their plans go far enough?
The net zero strategy is a huge series of documents, about 1,700-odd pages, in which the government sets out how it's going to reach net zero by 2050. And yet there are still big gaps, despite all the detail they've gone into. So, for instance, The government has decided against phasing out gas boilers by 2035, but there will be incentives for people to take up low-carbon heating before then. There also is not much on home insulation in the net zero strategy yet, and that's obviously going to be crucial. Britain's homes are among the leakiest and draftiest in Europe, and we need to fix that if we're going to reach net zero. The government also wants to expand offshore wind, which is crucial. There will be funding for at least one new nuclear power station. There will be funding for carbon capture and storage. There will also be more tree planting and restoring natural landscapes, which can absorb carbon. So there's a suite of different measures in there, looking at everything from cutting-edge technologies and new technologies to some quite old technologies, mature technologies like wind power and so on.
And as well as reducing emissions, reaching net zero also means removing carbon from the atmosphere, which you've mentioned and which is more complicated. Can you explain what that means and how you do it?
So you have a big source of emissions, like, for instance, a power plant burning fossil fuels, and you get the resulting carbon dioxide in a pipe. It comes out of a chimney. Instead of letting it just dissipate into the atmosphere, as happens at the moment, you would collect it, and then you would probably liquefy it, and then you would pump it underground, probably to somewhere like a disused oil field, which is, you know, already a kind of big cavern underground. And so you pump it under there and keep it indefinitely.
And hope for the best.
Yeah, pretty much. Carbon capture and storage is very controversial for several reasons. One is it's very expensive and it's rather untried technology. So relying on it is probably a bad idea. It's like trying to assume you'll have a get out of jail free card. We don't know whether it will work that way. So what campaigners are saying is that we really shouldn't rely on it. We should find other ways of reducing emissions by turning away from fossil fuels.
The British government says it's really proud of that strategy. Obviously, not everyone agrees. Even as it's setting out its plans, critics have pointed out that the UK has the biggest subsidies for coal, gas and oil in all of Europe. How can it square that circle?
The government needs to stop licensing new oil fields, oil and gas fields in the North Sea, really. They've resisted doing that. Now, there was a report from the International Energy Agency earlier this year, which said that if we want to stay within 1.5, really all new exploration and development of fossil fuels must stop after this year. And that report was actually commissioned by the UK government. And yet, the government's pressing on with new oil fields and licensing. So the government has said that any new oil and gas licenses must pass some climate checks, but it really looks bad to be hosting 196 countries in Glasgow and exhorting them all to reach net zero emissions while investing in fossil fuels yourself.
I mean, there's also a question of responsibility. I mean, for example, China has said that while they manufacture a lot, those goods are primarily consumed in the US and Europe. And there's a powerful argument that countries like Britain, which played such a big historical role in climate change, should bear more of a duty to fix it. Do the plans being set out by the UK and others reflect those debates?
Well, that's a debatable thing, because actually, if you look at China's emissions recently, China, as a historical emitter, is now bigger than the UK. So, you know, the developing countries that used to have very low emissions have now largely caught up, China, India, and a few others. So that historical emissions argument carries less weight. As for China providing us with exports, well, they don't do that out of the goodness of their hearts. They're paid for it. So really, they do bear a lot of responsibility in actually cleaning up their own industry. China does realise this. China realises that it's at risk from climate change, realises that it has a lot of other environmental problems like air pollution, and needs to clean those up. So China is investing heavily in renewable energy, and they do have plans to reduce their use of coal.
In the UK, meanwhile, there is a lot of talk about a just transition, which is the idea that you have to make sure that the places that are heavily reliant on fossil fuel industries aren't left in tatters. You might think of like the mining towns in the 1980s. Is that on the government's radar? I mean, what do you think a green industrial revolution should look like in those places?
The loss of jobs and the economic crisis in various parts of the country that were caused by the desertion of heavy industry and mining and so on in the 1980s, that was a choice. It didn't need to be done like that. There were other ways of managing that move away from certain industries. And that move was achieved without that huge social disruption in some other countries. So this is a choice again. There are jobs currently in high-emitting industries in fossil fuels that will need to go. But those people can be given jobs in equally important, equally skilled, equally high-paying green industries. It's not that we will cease to need energy. It's not that we will cease to need cars or any of these other goods. We will need them in a different form, and we will need people to do those green jobs. So this is a transition that can be managed. It's a choice that the government faces about how to manage it. They can just leave it to the market to decide, in which case there could quite easily be carnage, or they could manage it in a sensible way and have a just transition.
So Fiona, you've explained what it will take to get to net zero and what the UK's plan looks like at the moment. Is it enough?
It's not enough. The plans that we've seen so far for net zero do not add up to the emissions cuts that are needed. There are gaps and there are areas where we don't have enough funding. So for instance, if you look at certain industries, we will need to move the steel industry, for instance, away from high carbon steel. Similarly with cement and some other industrial processes, chemicals and so on. These industries need a pathway to move to low carbon. And without the government stepping in and looking at that and helping them, it's hard to see how they can achieve the move to low carbon and remain competitive without some form of government help.
Fiona, you've explained the 2050 net zero target, but it seems such a long way off that it may be hard for people to get their heads round. So what kind of targets are countries building into their plans as interim goals, and how likely are they to stick to them?
Countries need to have, as well as having a net zero target for 2050, countries need to have shorter term goals in order to reach that. We could get to net zero in 2050 and have emitted so much on the way that we would still go well beyond 1.5. So we need to reduce emissions before 2050. And in fact, we need to halve emissions this decade by 2030 in order to stay within 1.5 degrees. So that means countries need to come forward with these NDCs, nationally determined contributions, that are usually pegged to 2030 and show how they're going to achieve some greenhouse gas emitting goals by then. It doesn't stop, though. You don't just achieve your 2030 targets and move on. It's got to be a pathway that contains sharp cuts in the near term as well as longer term cuts. Otherwise, we will burst through the 1.5 degree limit.
Coming up, is COP26 the last chance to make net zero happen? Fiona, if I think of the previous COP summits, like Kyoto, Copenhagen, Paris, the first thing that comes to mind is that they were also billed as the last chance to save the world. Is that really true this time?
some governments quite reasonably are reluctant to say that this is the last chance for the very good reason that we need to keep going beyond Glasgow. Glasgow is not an end point. It's a beginning point, really, because countries need to come to Glasgow with good plans, but then they need to keep coming back with better plans. This is a race to get to net zero, and countries need to keep working on it. It's not that you can just stop at any point. In Paris in 2015, countries decided on two temperature goals, 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees. And what has become clear since then is that allowing emissions to rise to 2 degrees would be very dangerous, more dangerous than people realised. So that's why this COP has become even more urgent, because we really are losing the chance to stay within 1.5 degrees. We're already at 1.1 to 1.2 degrees of warming. And if we carry on emitting at this rate, and bear in mind that greenhouse gas emissions are still rising, they fell slightly during the pandemic, but they have resumed that upward track. If we don't bring them down sharply, then we will lose the opportunity to stay within 1.5. We will be doomed to higher warming. So yes, this is really, if not the last chance, pretty much the last chance.
Fiona, from everything you're saying, it's clear that a path to get to net zero is visible, but that we're just not on it yet. Anyone listening to this, I think, would think that there's nothing they can do. And so I'm wondering, how much of a role can normal people play in this? Does a public outcry over the climate crisis give any cause for hope?
When I started covering climate change in 2004, a lot of what we were talking about then seemed quite theoretical. We were talking about big changes some way in the future. But now, science has moved on. That form of attribution in climate science is much clearer now. So it's become much clearer to people. The impacts are there. They can be seen in the everyday world. Also, young people have realised this much more clearly.
We want change! We want change! We want change!
This is going to affect us most of all. When we're moving into new places and there's going to be more floods, and it's really our generation that's going to be hit by the most in 11 years.
If we want to ensure a safe presence and future on planet Earth, we need to be active democratic citizens and go out on the streets like we are doing today.
This is what democracy looks like!
And we want democracy!
This is what democracy looks like!
If we're talking about 2050, to someone my age, that I'll be really old by then, you know. But someone who's just growing up now, they'll be in the prime of their life at that point. So, really, it's become of much more pressing interest to young people around the world, and they are really the engine of bringing forward action.
Fiona, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Fiona Harvey. My thanks to her. You can find all of the environment team's reporting ahead of the COP26 summit at theguardian.com. One more thing. I wanted to let you know that Grace Dent's Comfort Eating is coming back for a new season, starting off tomorrow with a lovely and very funny interview with Stephen Fry. Do find it on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your Guardian podcasts. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Alex Atak. Original music and sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.